The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have made engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Space Show on Monday afternoon, California time. I am your host, David Livingston. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. Let me run through the usual typical announcements. For those of you that would like to call our show today, it is toll-free 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners, so be patient. We'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. And I'll also answer the phone if it's ringing during the break. So don't hesitate to use the toll-free number. But you can also use email. It is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. That is our website, thespaceshow.com. So we do have a very detailed newsletter in the middle of the page. You can't miss it. So it has all of the details of the week's programming, guest bios, and it's the only place where we have a future events section for the Space Show. So check that to see what's in store over the next several weeks or sometimes the next couple of months. Also, sometimes we have to change our schedule during the week and a show you think is going to be on at a certain time is not there. And before panicking, check the website newsletter to see if we've changed the schedule, because sometimes we do have to change or modify our schedule, and we let everyone know about that on the website newsletter. Everything we do is archived, so you can listen right off of our website and easily download these shows. And you can do the same on our blog. Plus, on the blog, you can post comments and communicate with other listeners, and many of the guests participate in blog conversations as well. That is thespaceshow.wordpress.com. There is a store on our website, upper left-hand corner of the homepage, Space Show Gear. Hope you check it out and visit it. And then you'll see the important button there, Support the Space Show. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And we exist because many of you do support us. We thank you for that support. We would not be here without it. If you do have any questions, check out OneGiantLeapFoundation.org or feel free to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And remember, as a 501c3, if you're paying U.S. federal taxes, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. And the same is true for those of you very fortunate to pay the California taxes, because we're a California public benefit corporation. We're also brought to you and partially sponsored by the Secure World Foundation. They help to promote cooperative solutions for space security. Plus, they sponsor our webinar series. For more information, check out their own website, www.swfound.org. And podcasting is through GigaDial, and you can find us in iTunes, Podcast Alley, astrospacenow.com, yastro.com, and a host of other places on the net. If you have any podcasting questions, please don't hesitate to give me an email. Again, drspace@thespaceshow.com. I'm very happy to introduce all of you today to Dr. Cameron Smith. And I discovered him by some listeners sending me a link to a lecture he gave in Canada, Interstellar Voyaging and Evolutionary Transition, which I have seen. Dr. Smith has been teaching human evolution and prehistory since 1999. He completed his doctorate in archaeology at Canada's Simon Fraser University in 2004. He teaches a wide variety of 100 to 400 level courses in world prehistory, field and lab methods, and regional topics. He's also involved with National Archaeology in Ecuador and PSU's long-term Wapato Valley Research Project. Research interests include Northwest Coast archaeology, evolution in general, Aboriginal watercraft user analysis, and the adaptation of humanity and our domesticates to off-Earth environments, i.e. space colonization. And on the website where I posted his bio, you will see the link to his complete CV, which is at Portland State University. Dr. Smith, welcome to the Space Show. How are you?
Thanks, Dr. Livingstone. I appreciate it. I'm just fine. I'm happy to be here. Looking forward to an interesting conversation.
I'm sure it will be. So just use David, and I'll call you Cameron as
well. Very good.
Coming at interstellar voyaging from archaeology and prehistory that you've been doing and that you teach and work in, how did you get to interstellar voyaging and interstellar space travel?
Well, good question, because in anthropology, typically, you think of an anthropologist or an archaeologist, and you think of study of the distant human past, which will be archaeology. And if you're looking at modern anthropology, sort of, how do human cultures work worldwide, that's a careful examination of the human present. But there's typically not a whole lot of consideration for a distant human future, a distant human future. And I think a distant human future should be thought about. There are certainly people making plans and thinking about a distant human future who could use my help, I think. There is, for example, a wonderful organization that I'm a member of called Icarus Interstellar. And they're planning, or they're starting to make plans for serious, scientifically valid plans to put humanity into long-distance space colonies and long-distance space migration. So I think if we're going to do all of that, I think that's an important thing to do. And I think if we're going to try to do that, then they could use the lessons of anthropology. What have we learned about our species that can help us?
How do you take what we've learned over so many thousands of years, and then try to extrapolate it into something that might be applicable at the minimum a couple of hundred years in the future, but it could be a lot more into the future.
Well, there are a couple of ways to answer that. There are a couple of answers to that, or two levels of answer. One level is very practical sort of advice, or very practical sort of concerns with designing of, let's say, a ship that's going to go to Alpha Centauri or Epsilon Eridani, something like this. If you actually, let's say that the physics people, the propulsion people, cook up something that'll get us to, let's say, 0.03 light speed, and we can make one of these voyages at 0.03 light speed in something on the order of 4 centuries, that's in a thoughtscape that is reasonable to us. And so it's sort of like the distance between Shakespeare and us today. So on the scale of that distance, well, what do we know from human biological anthropology? That's the study of human genetics and human biological nature. And what do we know about cultural anthropology that can help us sort of, think productively about, okay, a closed population of people for 4 centuries? What is involved with that? That's one way. That's a sort of a practical, hands-on, nuts and bolts way to use the lessons of anthropology for this large, kind of mind-boggling project. Another one is much broader, and it's one that I'm working on now, and it has to do with essentially adaptation. What we've learned is that humanity is extremely adaptable. We can, we're widespread, we're all across the globe, and yet we're only one species. Most animals that are so widely spread across the globe started out as perhaps one variety, but then they speciated, right? They adapted biologically to each different little microhabitat. Well, humanity is global, but we're also one single species. And so we have used adaptation, which is one of the major forces of evolutionary change. We've used adaptation more effectively than any other variety of life. And so if that is the tool that we've used to succeed adapting here, then I think that over the long term, we should use everything that we know about adaptation, and you can take adaptation apart into little components, everything that we know about adaptation, and apply that to the larger project of long-distance space colonization, so that, again, we have a guide based in science, based on what we know about the human path. We have a framework, a guideline to sort of help us make better plans.
You already have an email question from a listener. This is Janice, who's nearby in Seattle for you.
Great.
And Janice says, in the show today and in many other shows, you're certainly not the only one, you start off with the assumption that how are we going to do this? But my starting point would be, why should we do this? What is important about it? Why should this get any attention whatsoever? Unless you can convince and answer that question for millions of people who could care less about space, this is a non-starter.
Well, you know, they're sort of like the last one. There are a lot of ways to answer that. For a long time, the model has been, and it certainly is in the consciousness here in the United States, because this is how we've done space. The model has been that you've got to convince everybody, because the only way you can do space is taxpayer dollars, and so everybody has to be invested. Well, that might not be the model forever. And it might only need extremely dedicated people with a lot of resources to make something like this a possibility. For example, you see Elon Musk making plans to go to Mars. And okay, so this is one approach, private. Another one is, we don't know who's going to do it. We don't even know what the exact motives will be. But if the premise is that it's a good idea, and I'll give it the identity of species insurance. If the premise is that it's a good idea, then it should be done well, and so we should start thinking about it now. I come to that perspective from that work with Icarus Interstellar. They're working on the plan to take the next century, or this century, and spend this century thinking it over, not building anything, not even looking for much money, but spending this century with a multi-generational research effort to put together all the puzzle pieces so that perhaps by the end of the century we have a lot of other people convinced, or by the end of the century at the end of the century we have the capacity to do it. I don't know that you need to convince millions or billions of taxpayers anymore. I'm not sure that that's necessarily the case. You think of Interstellar or any kind of star voyaging, space voyaging, you think it's very expensive. I think those costs are going to change radically and quickly.
Is there a minimum number that you might have to convince? There's a minimum number for, say, a population to survive, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. With regard to I forgot to answer the last thing on the previous question was about the reason for it. Why do it? My real motivation for the whole thing is species insurance. I'm a prehistorian, and I've spent my adult life, my career, looking at the remains, the dust of ancient civilizations. So Inca, Maya, Aztec, Sumeria, Harappa, Shang, right?
Right.
Egypt, they are museum exhibits. And it's rattling around in my head now, and it's starting to be a phrase that even annoys me, but it's here's a catch line, is the reason that I have a job is that civilizations fail. And I think that extension into space is a completely natural continuation of evolution of Earth life, and including human life. And I think it's completely natural, and it's a responsibility, I think, not a luxury. So for all those reasons, I think species insurance by way of space settlement is critically important. We must do it.
So you're talking about getting a certain number of people off the planet if Earth is about to meet its maker, right?
Well, it is. I mean, we would really be beating the odds if this civilization weren't to have a terrible crash or terrible calamity. Now, it doesn't have to be sort of these zombie apocalypse scenarios that are so popular now. But all you have to do to completely preclude sort of really helping yourself out a lot is to have a return to sort of medieval conditions. And even that, it doesn't require people in fascist uniforms walking down the streets. All it requires is taking away a lot of the sort of niceties and the free things that we think about today, like universities, funneling all technology, for example, into the military sphere. The veneer of civilization, I think, is very thin, and we are only a tiny step away at any given moment from essentially medieval conditions. Medieval is so much simpler and cheaper that it's a default, I think, for civilization. So I think that I think of civilization as being extremely perilous and extremely fragile. For all those reasons, I think it should be safeguarded. You can look into Jared Diamond wrote Collapse a while back about collapses of ancient civilizations. It was okay more if you're interested in something that is a little bit more technically specific and uses a lot more information from the archaeological record. Look at the work of I think his first name is David Tainter, T-A-I-N-T-E-R. He has written extensively about the archaeology of collapse and disintegration of early civilizations.
Do we get to keep modern plumbing if we collapse?
Well, that's exactly one of the, you know, it's not, again, it's not necessarily sort of staggering down the streets, but it is 100 little blows like that. No, you don't get to keep that.
Well, you know, there are people living on Earth today that absolutely would like to live in the 15th century.
Oh, absolutely.
Or earlier,
yes.
Maybe even earlier, and they want to take us with them.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right, and we have to be careful of that, too. I like the scientific accumulation of knowledge and the laboratories that requires and the public investment that requires. You know, I value all of that. I value the good elements of Western civilization, and I want to keep them alive.
Perhaps we take it for granted and are too callous in how we cherish and regard it and protect it.
Well, you see exactly, this is so interesting how this conversation goes. When you start talking about space settlement and space colonization, you really get into, well, why are we doing it? And basically, is our civilization worthwhile? Should we keep it? I have a lot of students, actually, who come through and sort of might sometimes glorify or romanticize a past, a sort of agrarian past, where people sort of maybe got along better and weren't obsessed with all the technology and everything. And I'm afraid that didn't exist, and I'm afraid that that's not where we would go in the event of a collapse.
Yeah, I'm sure if you picked up someone from the 1860s in the Old West trying to figure out how to live with their family, they'd absolutely rather be where we are today.
could well be.
You have a caller on hold.
Sure, I'd love to hear it.
Good afternoon, caller. Who are you and where are you from, please?
Hey, this is John from Florida. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes, I can.
I can hear you, John.
Great. I'm so happy, David, you got a real live archaeologist on, because I had a question a few weeks ago that was right dead center for an archaeologist about a giant space issue. And it goes like this. If you had a civilization, now you could deal with it if it was a deal with the question is if the civilization was primitive or if it was as built up as current human civilization was with all the artifacts and industry and technology, and it did get whacked somehow, you know, an asteroid collision or something like that.
Yeah.
What would you have remaining after half a billion, a billion years? And before you answer it, the context is, some people are speculating that if Mars was likely blue and green and habitable a billion years ago, even if it had been very built up in advance, we might not see much remaining, if any, today.
Mm, yeah.
So you could talk about what would be remaining, and if you tried to find it, how would you try to find it?
Oh, yeah,
that's a billion years.
That's a great question. You know, when that picture, when they started getting the high-res pictures from the Mars orbiter of the face on Mars, you remember when
yeah.
that came in?
Right.
And you could finally look at it and really get a good look. Well, that thing is the size and shape of some of the Sumerian city-states. And it's got a big wall all the way around it, just like some of those. I examined it day after day. I got a huge printout of it, and I looked at it day after day after day, and I really wished to believe that that was the ruins of an ancient civilization on Mars. I couldn't convince myself, though. I think it's a natural feature. But You can absolutely you can do that. In archaeology, if we want to find traces of anything in the ancient world, we begin with a list of materials and we kind of think, all right, which of the residues, the material residues of that culture, you know, how long ago was it, roughly, and which of those material residues would remain? And then you start a specific search for those kinds of things. So half a billion, well, the paleontological record that we've got is half a billion years old, and there's a lot of fossil material from that time, right? The Cambrian explosion at 500 million years ago, we got thousands of fossils. So if the preservation conditions were okay, we might end up with a lot of fossils if there were a civilization there half a billion years ago, we might well find pieces of it. I would imagine if they reach a variety of technology that we have, that you could find it in space, for example, in satellites or orbital debris.
You'd find some trace of something that had been there that wasn't natural.
I would imagine, in orbit. Look at our orbit. We've done only 50 years of space, and it's thousands of pieces of bits of debris up there.
Well, but I think after a half a billion years of orbit.
Oh, yeah, they'd all come down, wouldn't they? Yeah.
Yeah, because
anyway, I think it's a fascinating question. I really wanted that thing to be. I thought, okay, there's my ticket. I can get to Mars as an archaeologist. But I'm afraid, no, it didn't convince me. I was not convinced.
What would our Sphinx look like if we could run it through a computer program and make it 1 billion years old?
Oh, I think it's is it granite?
And it doesn't have sandstone in it because it shows water and sedimentary and a lot of weathering?
I think all the sandstone will be gone. But the granite, the pyramids of granite, you know, a billion, those will be worn down, but I don't think they'd be completely wiped out, you know, if things remain about as they are now. You'd have to ask a geologist on that one, but I think lumps of the pyramids might remain.
Well, let me just add that the one part that I think bears emphasis is, you know, obviously the Sphinx and the pyramid are only 10,000, on the order of 10. They're not even 10,000 on the order. And they've just about gotten buried several times. And so I think the suspicion is that certainly, I mean, there were the two issues with a billion years ago. It seems unlikely anything would be on the surface.
Mm.
And, you know, then the question would be getting to it, and even if it's below the surface, would just natural processes, even metal, and would there be anything? So I just throw it out. That's something I think it's fascinating to a lot of people because it opens the speculative possibility that even though you land and you take pictures and it looks like Arizona and nothing there, maybe the remains are underground.
Yeah, two issues. Number one, where have we landed, right, and what have we seen? Small slivers. The other one is, this just reminds me, how do we do our field work? Well, one of the things that I would do in an environment like that is I would take along or have them tell me from the beginning the best geologists, because they can tell you what's called the depositional environment and the environmental history, and they'll be able to tell you, you know, how long did it take for the particular groundwork that you're the landscape that you're looking at, how long did it take for that to evolve, right, and what was before that? So collaboration with geologists who could tell you the depositional history of the environment would help a lot.
You know, this is a little bit off the subject of interstellar travel, but
yeah.
I've been on digs in the Middle East,
in
Jordan, and at one time in Syria and in Israel.
Oh,
and, you know, you find city on top of city, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it's somehow they keep building in the same site, but they go down really, really deep. So if you think that you're going to find that on Mars, for example, then you'd have to make the assumption that whatever cultures were there followed some of the similar habits of early cultures on Earth to build on top of other cultures and other cities. And that it could have nothing to do with reality on Mars.
So there are a lot of unknowns, and so I would support an archaeological expedition to Mars immediately.
Oh, yeah, wouldn't that be a fun dig to go on? If you could survive it, God, I'd sign up for that in a minute. I really enjoyed being on archaeological digs, and I even did underwater ones in Greece.
Oh, great.
So,
If I could make one last parting comment and then get off for room for other people, I think it would be great if Dr. Smith and other serious, for real archaeologists, geologists would write about this and, you know, understanding it's speculation, but write about this sort of thing and, you know, what are the possibilities, what sort of expedition might we undertake in the same way that decades ago serious astronomers like Carl Sagan wrote about the essentially radio and astronomical search for extraterrestrial intelligence. I think that'd be fantastic. You know, not a fringe group, but a real academic archaeologist and geologist group.
Well, all I can say is it's writing is a long. It takes a long time. And I'm kind of full up right now with working on these ideas to help the sort of colonization effort. At some point, though, I would like to see a scientific examination of that. But I think it's going to require a lot of information beforehand. For example, first let's find life on Mars, then let's find what variety of life, multicellular, you know, or just unicellular. I think we can make our way towards that. But I think it might be a while. Maybe let's put some explorers on the planet right away.
John, are you still there?
No, I think he got off the phone. But you know,
thanks,
on Earth, we have signs for this. Like we have little hills or tells. Plus,
yeah.
We have an incredible written history that kind of, even the Bible, that says this went, Megiddo
yeah.
was here, and this went on here. And you can actually find things that are representative of our written record. But, you know, on Mars, you'd be a needle in the haystack. You don't have any record of anything. So where would you even go dig underneath the face on Mars? I mean, the whole planet would be your playground, but without any specific starting or reference point.
Well, again, I think we got to first start with, you know,
so,
was there life? Then
baby
what
steps.
Varieties of life?
Yeah, baby steps.
Baby steps.
Baby
yeah.
steps, and then maybe discover some record that might lead you to do something different. But it is really a lot of fun to think about.
Oh, it's great topic.
and I would think if we were capable of going and doing interstellar flight, that this might be less unusual than it is in the way we're talking about it today.
Well, we simply, you know, we've been looking in a long time. We've been doing archaeology for more than 100 years, sort of in its modern form. We have not been looking out with you know, precision tools for very long. We've only been doing SETI for a little while, and you know, one generation of SETI, roughly. You know, I'm the first to give the benefit. No, not I don't give the benefit of the doubt. I'm the first to be excited when we hear of these exoplanets that might harbor life or possible, you know, even UFOs. They always get me excited, but I'm never convinced by them, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
Here's another question from Jerome in Tucson, and he said, do you think that robots could do as effective of exploration, at least in the early periods, as humans if we go out into space looking for things?
Very good question. It's not surprising to ask that because, you know, here in the States, we have been cut way back in the space program funding since, of course, the days of Apollo. And so everybody said, well, how can we do it cheaper? And one is cut out the humans in space part and do it by robots. Well, they can certainly help. They have you know, robotic probes have done the essential reconnaissance of our solar system, which is pretty incredible. Since the 1960s, we've pretty much gone to basically all the planets. We've pretty much got a good handle on them. We know their chemistry and all that. And even now one is coming to Pluto. So they have their function, but you know, for a lot of questions, I don't think they suffice. A geologist, or a team of geologists. I don't think we should ever go in small numbers to Mars, but let's say 10 geologists working on the surface of Mars. Oh, I think that they could come up with so much more information than a robot or a couple of robots or 10 robots. The human mind can make correlations. It can think by thinking. I mean, it can make correlations. It can see one thing and remember something else that isn't isn't it's tangentially important, this other thing that you remember when you see this new phenomenon. And when you make that link, you get creativity. When you new association, productive association of previously unassociated ideas, that's creativity. And we haven't been able to get that with artificial intelligence. So the human mind, I think, is much better exploration tool for the kinds of specific things that we're going to want to do on Mars.
We talked earlier about do we really need to pull the taxpayer along with us in some quantity or some number?
Mm.
Let me try it another way with you.
Yeah.
We've got this group of individuals. I'm going to use the word individual. I don't really know what they are, who they are. But you know, they're out there as space policy people that make our policy. So, you know, you and I could probably name a handful of them, but we probably couldn't name the top 300 or 200 that influence space policy.
Okay.
We don't know who they are or, you know, where they are or, you know, what they like, what they eat in the morning, how to influence them. You know, this is a big mystery. Who are the space policy gurus that make our space policy, right?
Good question.
Do we need to be concerned about convincing them of telling them of making the case to them? I mean, maybe we don't want their money, but we also don't want their interference.
You know, it's another great topic. I mean,
maybe you know who all these policy people.
No, I don't. But I you know, I grew up with NASA. I'm 49 today, actually.
Oh, happy birthday to you!
Thanks. So I would sit in Denton, Texas, when I was 10 years old. I'd sit in Denton, Texas. My dad would bring home reels of film, and he'd project them, you know, 8-millimeter film projected on the wall, showing me the lunar landings that were just happening in that time, right, 1969.
Right.
So I am the product of NASA in the 70s. And I grew up thinking that they were the greatest thing in the world and that they were going to take us to Mars. All of that has dissolved.
Yeah,
they have
too.
Been 10 years away from Mars for my entire life. So who are the policymakers and who are, I don't care. I don't want to know. We leave them behind. I think we leave them behind. It is much too important to be left to the federal system, which I don't think actually has a direction right now. So obviously a very a pretty hot topic. But I think that it's a much better approach, or at least, you know, we should have multiple approaches and not just one. And if it's hanging on the taxpayer whim, it might end up like Apollo, and I wouldn't like to see that happen.
Are we any better with an international approach?
I don't know. I guess I'm thinking in terms of biology. In terms of evolution and biology, you get variations on a theme, and eventually, you know, some of them make it and some of them don't. It's the whole history of aviation, from the Wright brothers to, you know, 747s.
Right.
Thousands of designs were attempted. Thousands of approaches were attempted in the 1920s and 30s when they were really sorting out the issues of powered flight. And there's a variety of selection going on there, a variety of natural selection. And the best designs in the end, the ones that didn't crash and kill people, those are the ones that we fly today. And I would do the same thing with in particular, lowering the cost of space access. The more people, more brains that we can have thinking about it, rather than 5 people at NASA or 10 people at Lockheed Martin, the more brains working on the problem, the greater the possibility that we're going to get one person, one genius out there is going to give us really low-cost space access. So I would say as many approaches as possible, international, private, combinations of those, federal, everything.
Interstellar might be, what, 100, 200, so many years away. How hard is it to, is it only conceptualizing that you can do when you're looking that far into the future? Or how specific can one get? Or just take you, for example, how specific can you get?
Well, I'm discovering that right now. So the thoughtscape that I'm working with is this one that Icarus Interstellar is working with. The thoughtscape is, you know, several centuries, less than 1,000 years, more than maybe 300 years. So And they're giving me those numbers because they're figuring, based on what we know of exoplanet distribution today and based on the kind of advances that they might be able to make in propulsion technology with real physics that they're thinking about now, they're saying this is sort of the thoughtscape. Less than 1,000 years, but more than about 300. So, okay. So in that time scale, let's assume it's a closed system. It's a large ship. And it's a closed system, an interstellar arc. It's taking along all our hopes and our genes and our ideas and literature. Everything is going in this arc. It's not abandoning Earth. It is giving us a backup in case of a disaster. So in this closed system, okay, it's got to stay closed until it reaches this exoplanet, and then you presume that you can replenish your consumables again. You get there, and there are resources there that you can use. So what do you do on that time scale? Well, based on what we know about human biological evolution, based on what we know about the human genome, based on what we know about how cultures function and dysfunction and so on, we can make recommendations. We can take this century to study it and make recommendations so that the decisions near the end of the century, using these new propulsion technologies that we expect to come online, those are good decisions, that the design is good, or at least it's a design that is informed by everything that we know about our species so far.
Is going to Mars, going back to the moon, things like that, is that a stepping stone in your opinion, or totally separate than going and trying to work an interstellar situation? Are there common reasons for doing? Do they naturally flow one to the other? I guess that's what I'm asking you.
Well, I think Mars does as a first step, and I think it's a good idea. We should go there and establish essentially a new branch of civilization there, and then that can be a stepping stone. Right? We learn how to do this kind of thing, and then maybe step further and go longer distances. Moon is interesting, but I'm convinced by Robert Zubrin, who's put in basically a lifetime of convincing us that Mars is a good place to settle. I'm convinced by his arguments, and his are largely philosophical, and his are that, to put it bluntly, he says anywhere but Mars, the cops are too close, which means that if you just go to the moon, you're still under the political structures, right, the political structures that exist here just by proximity, you're still going to be controlled by that. But he's saying that you go to Mars, you can have essentially independence, philosophical, legal, political, economic, biological independence, segregation, and you can start a new branch of civilization. I think that's the project. I think that is a good idea.
The cops are too close. I like that.
Yeah.
So you kind of get your freedom by going to Mars.
Well, that's, you know, this is where our country started, right? People were dissatisfied.
Uh-huh.
And had to leave, well, went for all kinds of reasons. But and things are somewhat different. My younger brother has moved to Europe. He's finding conditions of life and so on are better there. Well, that's the opposite of what my mom did. She came here in 1961, from the wreckage of post-war Germany, so people move around to where there are perhaps better opportunities or a more palatable life, and maybe people will see that kind of thing on Mars. There is a whole planet to explore. It will draw explorers. I would move there tomorrow. I could drop everything and go there tomorrow because I know that there's an entire planet to explore, and I love exploration.
Absolutely. So when you bring this up to your students, you mentioned before the show you sort of do it at the end of a class or end of a semester.
Sometimes, yeah.
Is there interest from the students, or do they just wonder what?
A tiny percentage of people or of students become interested, and a couple of them have joined me in some projects. And so, yeah, I'm happy to see that.
Do you think if you taught this as a full class that it would make it at your school? Do you think you'd have enough enrollment and all that?
Well, I think the hardest part would be convincing the dean that it was a worthwhile class, a worthwhile academic subject. I certainly think it is. I think again, just before the interview, we were talking about the International Space University. There's a university in Strasbourg, and they specifically, it's a master's project, the program, but they specifically do space studies, everything from the legal aspects to technical aspects. I think there should be more of those. I think there should be more departments of space studies so that we can start to think about humans in space and not just spy satellites in space.
All very, very interesting, but the line I like the best is the cops are too close.
Yeah, I like that one, too. It's pretty memorable. Robert Zubrin is a peppery guy.
Yeah, I haven't had him on the show for a while. He's long overdue. But
Bring him back.
I have to ask him about that, but the next time someone tells me they want to go to the moon, I may just say, well, you know, the cops can be awfully close.
Yeah.
That, I think, says it all. For interstellar flight, in working on Interstellar, I do a lot of programs with people from Icarus Interstellar, and Kelvin Long was just recently on the show as well.
Great.
But, what's the secret of getting a typical person to grasp their mind around something that is so very far into the future that they're not going to ever live to see, but yet they should be interested in it?
It's hard to do. It is hard to do. Even it is hard for me to write. So I've written one book about this, and now I'm writing another one, which is much more technical. And it takes a lot of effort. You know, it takes a lot of faith in the idea that humans are actually going to get it together, at least on this level, and actually make a move, make a very bold, sort of incredible sort of thing. And you can be sitting there writing and thinking that, you know, this is going nowhere, nothing is ever going to happen. But then you remember, no, look at the history of humanity. There's a long, it's been around for a long time. We've done pretty incredible things. We've done a lot of terrible things. We've also done a lot of magnificent things. And I've got so many, again, students who are dissatisfied with Western civilization. And I have to remind them, well, what about the art? What about the literature? What about the music? All the great things? We have a thing called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We wrote those words down, you know. I guess you have to remember the good parts. You have to and think that it's worthwhile, to preserve them.
You've been teaching for quite a while. Is this dissatisfaction with Western civilization, is this a new trend, or has this been around for decades?
Oh, no. I think even 10 years ago, it was a different atmosphere and a sort of dissatisfaction or sort of a collapse mentality wasn't really on the horizon. Somewhere in the last 10 years, the idea of impending doom. Maybe it's partly political, right? The United States is politically severely divided,
right?
And it might have a lot to do with that sort of dynamic or cultural zeitgeist, the feeling of the times.
But then it would seem to me that space could be a solution and a path out of that.
Well, that's what they were. Selling in the 1960s after the moon. They were, von Braun and all of these guys who had a larger vision from the very beginning were saying, no, don't stop at the moon. That's not what it's about. It's about what even Tsiolkovsky back at the turn of the century, for your listeners who don't know, he's the Russian theoretical mathematician, basically.
The rocket equation thing.
Yeah, he publishes the rocket equation, and he codifies what people knew, but he codifies it, and he gives us rocketry. But his whole, it wasn't about, I have to remind people this oftentimes, it wasn't about the rockets, and space colonization isn't about rockets or robots or computers, it's about humans. It's about humans adapting to new environments. And I guess the last part is that you see that big projects like that, let's say going, you know, putting people on the moon, well, that's 500,000 American people who are working on it over the space of 10 years. So, you know, you get overwhelmed, you only can play a tiny little part, nothing is moving quickly enough, but you have to realize it's these big movements are composed of thousands of tiny little parts, and so you've got to play your own little part.
We're at our halfway point, so I'm going to take our break here.
Great.
And we'll pause, listeners. We'll be back in about 3 minutes, and the toll-free line is available, 1-866-687-7223. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Monday Space Show program. Dr. Cameron Smith is our professor of honor today on the Space Show, and he is definitely that. It is his birthday, so if I could sing, I would sing happy birthday to our guest, but I'm going to let that go. But if any of you out there are choral singers or singers and you want to call in and sing happy birthday to him, actually, you can't do that. Didn't they? The guy who has the copyright,
oh,
didn't
it's a
he,
copyright issue now.
Didn't he raise his ugly head and go after people who were
saying happy birthday?
You
get a thin little letter in the mail from the Department of Justice.
Yeah, so don't sing happy birthday, but you can wish him happy birthday. I have an email for you, and we're talking about interstellar work and flight and, you know, issues around that, but John in Florida, now this is the same John who called a few minutes ago.
Sure.
So he says, although my call in question was about a billion-year-old remains from the blue-green era on Mars, has Dr. Smith fully dismissed the hypothesis that the face and other features at Cydonia on Mars could be archaeological, likely from a more recent era? I would love to hear more details about his thoughts about Cydonia.
Well, you know, this is how science works. You have somebody makes an observation, and they make a claim. So the observation was, hey, there's a thing that looks like a face. And then the claim followed, which was, it must be the relic of an ancient civilization. So then science says, well, I can't handle just a claim. I need evidence. So we have another orbiter there, and it's looking more carefully. And the evidence that is assembled, it does not support the hypothesis that it is a face. And so for me, yes, I've looked at it very closely. I spent more time looking at that than I perhaps even should have, based on the sort of improbability of something like that lasting for 500,000,000 years. However, I gave it about as good as a shot as it could get. I gave it about as much consideration as it deserved, and that was quite a lot. And I was very excited about it. And I measured it. I had a big printout of this, like a poster, and I measured it, and I looked at it carefully, and I just was not convinced. I just wasn't convinced, based on everything that I know about how humans, at least, or our variety of life forms, builds things. It just didn't match up with what we know of ancient structures. Now, that all presumes that this is a human culture, or a primate-derived culture. Well, again, that's really stretching things. Primates don't appear until 100 million years ago, or sorry, 65 million years ago on Earth. So I'm presuming if there was a variety, if there were varieties of life on Mars at the blue-green period half billion years ago, they would be probably some different variety of multicellular life. And I don't preclude that, but we haven't yet got evidence for it. So I would love to follow that line of investigation. I think it's fascinating, but I think maybe 50 years from now we'll have the basic understanding of ancient Mars biology to start down those lines. I wish we were there.
So you trust the data coming back that it's authentic and objective so that you can work with it and draw conclusions from it?
Yeah, I do not put it beyond any government or commercial agency to alter their data. But I haven't ever been convinced of that when I hear of data coming from Mars, for example. Millions of images have been returned from these probes, and systematically trying to alter or hide things wouldn't work because so many people are looking at them. You put any image on the Internet, and it's instantly scrutinized by thousands of people who do nothing but sit around and scrutinize images. So I think any imposture in that kind of imagery or data would be instantly detected. No, I trust the data.
Another question is by email. And listeners, surely some of you can use the phone. It's much more fun than email. 1-866-687-7223. So Bijan is in Sweden, excuse me. And he says, humans have been pretty bad at handing down their knowledge to later generations. X-ray is now used to try to read the ashes of scriptures by forgotten philosophers who lived only 2,000 years ago. Do you think that this says something about communication with extraterrestrial intelligence or even with our own future interstellar colonists? Does interstellar time lags doom us to archaeological isolation?
Well, I guess that's what I'm trying to avoid, or that's what I'm trying to help. A lot of people have the same idea. Avoid is that becoming just dust. And in 2001, A Space Odyssey, the book, there are just a few pages that describe it, but Arthur Clarke describes the distant, very distant future for humanity. And he describes these life forms who have actually adapted biologically to space, don't even require machinery, don't even require starships anymore. And I think that's a very provocative and interesting possibility, and for all kinds of reasons, I think it's very interesting for all kinds of reasons, but you have to survive to get there. And so I'm looking much more at sort of the nearer distant future rather than the distant future. So a lot of those, I think those are very interesting ideas. I haven't examined them. If you're in Sweden, you might see a recent issue of a journal called Glänta, G-L-A-N-T-A. And I have an article in there about interstellar colonization. It is in Swedish, not English.
Oh, so Bijan, if you get a hold of that article and
yeah,
you read it, not necessarily today, but maybe on our open line show next Sunday, tell us about it. And what edition is it? Is it the current edition? Was it?
It's, I've got a hard copy here, but it is online too. It's called Glänta, G-L-A. A has an umlaut.
Right.
N-T-A, and then edition 2.14.
Do you speak Swedish? Is that
no? It was translated. I sent them the text in English, but it's. I always like to have. I have something also in South America. I think it was in Brazil, and I really love to have our articles translated into different languages to get it out of just the, English-speaking world.
So have you tried Klingon yet?
No. No. There's a lot of people here in Portland, I think, speak Klingon, but not me.
Well, I mean, that might count as another language for you.
It would.
To publish in. So going back to interstellar flight, I mean, what do you think is, how do we get started on it? What I know what Icarus Interstellar, you know, is working on, and I know their DARPA 100 plan and and things like that, but how do you see it? What are the starting points for here in 2015 that might prove relevant and have a payoff a couple of hundred years down the road?
Well, I think just what we're doing. Don't reach too far too quickly. Don't turn into a plant a flag on Mars and then you know stop for another 50 years. Break out of our old way of doing things, which was necessary. It was an exploratory mode. Move towards productive scientific understanding of how we can do settlement of space, not just popping up and staying for short times. There are a lot of books I've read in the last few years about the history of the American and Russian space station programs over the last 25 years.
Uh-huh.
And those space stations are very interesting, and the experiments they've done on them are very interesting. But it's been pointed out, for example, that none of them have, in a significant way, tried to make their systems self-sustaining, growing, not just growing condiments like mints or peppers, that kind of thing. They do that. But I mean growing the staple calories or having a completely a system that is a completely closed ecology. They're still taking up, you know, all of their consumables are shuttled up there in cans, essentially, pressurized vessels and all kinds. And I know it's very difficult, and I know that they might say, well, geez, we're just getting started. I get it. But we should, you know, we should increase our efforts to make those things self-sustaining and put them on track for understanding humanity in a mode of adaptation to new environments, rather than just an orbital lab to see what's, you know, what can be done, let's say, with microgravity experiments yes, I do want all of the science, the physics and all of that. I'm just saying, you're asking, what can we do to start? One of the things that we can do to start is increase the emphasis on those and being self-sustaining.
You have another caller on hold.
Thanks.
Hang on. Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is John from Florida again, and no one else is calling in, so I thought I'd call if that's okay.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Thanks, John.
I had another question when you started talking a little bit about the isolation. If we don't find a way to get over this speed of light issue, you know, we're talking about just generational arcs and stuff like that. That brings up sort of the Fermi paradox, and that may actually be the answer to it, but I was curious what Dr. Smith, if he's familiar with the Fermi paradox, what his thoughts were on it, and if he's not familiar, I could explain it.
It's where is everyone? Isn't that it? If it's so easy for life to evolve, then how come the universe isn't crowded with non-human life forms? All I know is that a lot of minds much better equipped than mine have tackled it, and they haven't sorted it out. I know Frank Drake has gone after it. It is a paradox. Maybe it still has the status of a paradox because we haven't solved it yet. I guess the only thing that I can productively say or point out is that, you know, with the tools that we have, we've only been looking for one generation, roughly. And I think that's not very long.
Should we be... Well, I mean, maybe you can deal with your thoughts about this. Before we even get to Interstellar, shouldn't we be spending a lot of effort within the solar system? And really, even on Earth, to try to see if we can find any evidence. And I'm not here trying to support some of the really fringe people who sort of make ridiculous claims and want to believe things.
Yeah.
But, you know, given the fact that the scales of distance are not only so great, but yet the numbers are so great, we would expect many life and maybe a very advanced life that could visit us or maybe even exist in the solar system a long time ago to appear many times, given you have, it's an unbelievable number of star systems, that it could very well be the case that we have evidence here, but it's just very, very old, or it's not on Earth. You know, I guess we have billions of years, we know, of prehistory, and even on Earth, you know, the remains in Egypt and all are less than 10,000 years old. The fossils we get from dead animals do go back millions or tens of millions, maybe further, but they're not even the original substance. There's some sort of imprint. I assume always deep underneath something.
Yeah.
So what do you think? What are your thoughts on that, Dr. Smith?
Well, again, I think it's you know, it's the whole field of it's the field of exobiology. It didn't even exist 40 years ago. I think they invented the term exo, so off of Earth, biology, study of life beyond Earth. I'm looking right now, sitting here in my office, and on the shelf of my bookshelf here, among thousands of anthropology books, there's one called Principles of Bioastronautics. And in that, there's a geneticist, his name is Lederberg, and in the 30s he printed a paper talking about the possibility of life beyond Earth. And he was doing it from a scientific standpoint. So then in the 60s, they invented the field of exobiology. The place that exobiology is in right now, in terms of the maturation of a science, the place that it is at now is still in outlining the principles of precisely what life is, and that gives you a conception of where life might live beyond Earth, and then they're starting now with Kepler and all these other probes. They're starting to look at exoplanets, for example, for, you know, for those kind of conditions, and the possibility of, you know, very specific things like, well, half a billion years ago at blue-green Mars, half a billion years ago, was there life that could build structures? I'm afraid we're just not there yet. I wish we were. But do you see what I mean about the maturation of exobiology? It's still an immature science. They're just starting out.
Yeah, I think an important point that you're hitting on in general is that if we look at how long it was, so many of the things we know about science and the solar system and the universe are not really all that old. Like, I was trying to figure out when it was the first time that we really realized, someone measured the distance of the stars and realized how far away it was. I think when I looked up on Wikipedia, it was before the Civil War, but you know, the vastness of the universe and seeing details on the other planets and stuff like that with telescopes, it's very recent. I mean, we're not even at 60 years past Sputnik. So yeah. I think that's what you're saying, right?
That's what I'm saying. And I think we might get there, and we you know, if science continues, and we can continue to support civilization and all that, we might be able to know all that at some point. I wish we knew it now, but we just have to have more time. I think it's got to. We need to know those basic things before we look for specific things. I hope we'll get there.
Yeah, I certainly do, too. Of course, the thing is, it's not going to happen. I mean, even if all of us on the line were really young, it's still, you know, the extent to which we can dream, none of it would be fulfilled in our lifetime. Although I'm with you, Dr. Smith. You know, I'm 46. You said you were 49?
Yeah.
And it's just a great disappointment in my lifetime. You know, that we haven't at least reached where we to where we could go. I mean, there's a YouTube video of Wernher von Braun. Maybe I'll forward it to David. You can probably find it if you just go to YouTube.
Yeah.
And he's giving a talk in 1975 or so, and he's saying, you know, he could do Mars. We would do Mars in the early 80s.
We could have done all of that could have been done. You know, the other day they're talking about, well, maybe putting people on Mars by 20, you know, in the 2030s. Well, probably the, you know, in the world, in these realms, probably the most frustrated person on Earth must be Robert Zubrin, again, president of the Mars Society, because he has outlined for decades, he's outlined all the technology was there 25, 30 years ago. It could have been done, but they, you know, the national will wasn't there. People didn't want, people didn't, well, I shouldn't say that. It's very complicated. When they do polls of interest in space and should we go to Mars and everything like that, among the general public, interest is always very high. 70-80% of people, they think, yeah, we should go to Mars. But the purse strings, the government purse strings that control the funds, they have not opened up since after Apollo. Not for manned space exploration. And why that is the big mystery. And so, like I'm, you know, same generation as you, and like I said to Dr. Livingstone before, forget it. Leave them behind and do it privately. We've got to go. We can't wait for them anymore.
Well, I love to. I usually bring up Zubrin when I call in, and he one time mentioned on the show digging for fossils. He said he thought there was life on Mars even now, but he seemed to suggest it, you know, microbial, maybe under the surface. But he also mentioned putting people on the ground to dig for fossils.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. That'll be. I'm sure that will be a major part of any geological, exploration. Any geological or scientific exploration is going to be highly focused on finding fossils.
Yeah, I mean, the disappointment, you know, you talked about sort of giving up on at least direct, bold government initiative. One of the things that's so heartening is, seeing SpaceX and their recoverable boosters, and they just put the animation of the Falcon Heavy. It's very heartening because if they bring the cost down by an order or two of magnitude, at least an order of magnitude, it will happen because somebody will bypass the government at that point. It'll, you know, when you get down, and I think Zubrin and some others were quoting low-end private missions. Some people were speculating down to $2 billion or under.
Oh, yeah.
And when it gets down there, it will happen, whatever.
Yes, yes. And I've grazed in this, or been grazed by, or I've been in contact with some of these. For example, I've been at SpaceX, and I can't really talk about it in what capacity, but I've been there, and I can tell you that they are, it's not just Elon Musk who is dedicated to it. You go in there and talk to people, and it is an evangelical zeal. The company SpaceX exists to colonize Mars. So I think it's awfully exciting. I've been with Copenhagen Suborbitals in Denmark, and they have the project of putting a human being into space, suborbital space, but into space by private method. They want to show that it doesn't have to be so expensive and complicated. They've made big progress. They've got an award from the International Aviation Federation for their active guidance rockets. So they're making progress. And Peter Madsen, who split off from that group, he's continuing. So people are working on private space access and making it cheaper. And it's very exciting. And I think it's very fragile, and it's very much like the 1920s in aviation right now. And there are going to be a lot of things that fail, and a few things are going to work. And a lot rests on these private efforts, I think.
Well, certainly, our hopes and dreams right now. I mean, the government is really the main customer still, and that's okay. I mean, the problem is the way the government buys. But if with the SpaceX people and others, if they bring the cost down enough, you know, government buy or otherwise, it'll have to happen, which is very heartening. One last thing I might mention, it's sort of interesting that came up. is when you were talking about, you know, you were talking about the 300 year arc programs.
Yeah.
That we, you know, if we can't get over FTL issues, yeah. or speed of light issues. We'll have to go to that at some point. There's some really out there television science fiction. I don't know if you saw it recently that sort of dealt with this. A really out there way, but very interesting. I thought it was dealt with kind of well. It's called Ascension on the Sci-Fi Channel.
No, wanted to see it. I was talking with David before. I don't watch or read much science fiction, but I have really enjoyed some of it. And I wanted to see that, but I didn't watch it.
I have it recorded, John. Should I actually sit down and watch it?
You should watch it. I thought it was, you know, it's entertaining. You know, it's not meant to be a super serious speculation. It's, you know, it's over the top. It's as if, you know, circa 1963, JFK secretly launched, like, a Project Orion-type arc ship, you know, like Freeman Dyson was working on. And, you know, they really stretch everything, and I won't tell you the spoiler of it. There's an incredible twist that gets into an incredible twist of archaeology. And I don't know, it was a six-hour, a lot less with commercials, mini-series, and they're talking about renewing it. But I thought it was well done. You know, it's flashy and everything, and it brings up some of the, you know, sociological issues you have with a multi-generational ship.
Well, I may watch it, but I'm easily entertained. I'll watch Wyatt Earp from the Nostalgia TV show from the 1950s. So,
sometimes you talk about the hot girls. It's definitely got that. David, so.
What, not Wyatt Earp, Ascension probably has.
Yeah, Ascension, oh yeah, yeah. So if you can't, I think the science and the science fiction's enough to keep you going, but if it isn't, it's worthwhile for the other aesthetic.
If there were any hot girls in those Westerns back in the 50s, you'd never know it by the way they dressed them and hit them. So.
Well, wait, wasn't there the Jane Russell, Howard Hughes thing?
I don't remember that.
The Outlaw, where, you know, he...
I don't remember.
Designed outfit for her.
I don't remember that one.
Okay. Anyway.
But that's another story. You know, I do shows on science fiction movies for space and Mars and the moon from time to time. I enjoy talking about them, especially the cheesy ones from the 50s and the 60s.
I'll have to check that out.
Like From Earth to the Moon, and some of those were really, you know, fun movies to see. But
something worth pointing out about. Along those lines, I think somebody on the show was recently talking about how they were inspired by the Disney animations in the 50s. Those are on YouTube. There's three of them for free. There's three. There's Man in Space, like Man in the Moon and Man in Mars. Great stuff, just right there on YouTube.
Yeah, I've done full shows on that before. So you need to go back through the archives. Let me clear the line in case somebody else wants to get in.
Okay.
Thank you, John.
Take care.
Thank you.
Callers, the line is clear, 1-866-687-7223. Our Swedish friend wants to know if you have heard about the idea to send a telescope to the gravitational lens of the sun about 1% of the distance to the nearest star, and do you think that could be an important and inspiring stepping stone to interstellar travel, which we could actually do this century?
This is putting a telescope, where is it going?
He says to send a telescope to the gravitational lens of the sun about 1% of the distance to the nearest star.
I don't know. I'm presuming that simply means that it's going to give us a better look, like putting a telescope on the backside of the moon, for example.
Uh-huh.
And if that's the case, or if that's the objective, I think that would be great. There's a great book called Centauri Dreams by Paul Gilster, Gilster. He also has a website of the same name. And in that book, he describes a lot of very exciting, because they are creative ways that people are looking at in near time, not spending 100 years, but in near time, sending, for example, microprobes to interstellar space. So that sounds familiar. I don't know that plan specifically, but it sounds familiar. And yes, I would be, you know, who knows what's going to work to motivate, right, such a project. And so if it's a telescope in a particular place that gives us astounding new views of things, I'm all for it. I'm all for any of these approaches. You know, we spent, I looked at the American discretionary budget, the budget that they can be spent on whatever we want the other day. And 55% of our spending right now is military. So, and I think that a large part of that is boondoggles and waste. Look at this new fighter that nobody wants, and it doesn't do what it was supposed to. So I think there's a terrible amount of waste there. And when people say, oh, we shouldn't spend money on the space program, well, perhaps we shouldn't spend money on these weapon systems that, in the end, are they really worthwhile? So I'm all for all kinds of space activity.
You have an email from Paula, who is in Denver, and she says, David, I'm at work, so I'm using email. My question is, I always hear about needing to do inspiring things for the younger kids, the younger population. Do you think that we really need to be focused on inspiring rather than maybe just getting out and doing something?
Well, that's great. And I've spent a lot of time writing about and doing talks on and sort of popularizing just beyond my classes. Another topic that seems to, you know, people either love it or hate it, which is evolution. And so I write books about evolution and popular science articles, that kind of thing. And at some point, you know, you have to realize, well, once adults have made up their mind about something, they can be quite tough to change. And so you should start with kids. You know, start educating children about the facts of biology. But it takes a particular skill to write for children, I think. And I've looked at a beautiful book, I've got it here on my shelf, a beautiful book, you know, it's a kid's book on how evolution works, and it's really great, but I couldn't have written it. It's a very different kind of writing than what I do. So I think people do need to do that, but I think, you know, it needs the right people to do that.
So just being a space advocate and going out to Rotary or something like that to try to inspire people, but you're kind of lukewarm on that kind of activity.
Well, no, I do that.
Oh, okay.
I do that, partly because, you remember I was saying before, you know, the question was, how do you do it? How do you keep motivated? How do you keep going when
right.
it seems like this thing is so far out? Well, one is, I guess, you have to be able to converse with people who kind of share your perspective, and that keeps you kind of going, and you think, yeah, this is still worthwhile. There are other people. I'm completely alone and with a crazy idea. So I do those, but you know, and I hope that some of them, people who are who have kids, for example, hopefully they'll take that message to them, and they'll you know, but they're better equipped to do that than I am.
Yeah, I just did a Rotary talk on space, and it was a big hit with all the people.
Oh, great!
So they what I was surprised about was how ignorant about our space program and space policy these people are, who are leaders in the business community, pretty affluent, and all very well educated, and yet they don't know anything about our space program. Let alone the Defense Department space program, China. I mean, they don't even know what's written in the newspapers.
Well,
I was stunned.
Yeah, you know, there's also this really disturbing thing that has sort of swarmed once the internet came along, which was the idea that the moon landings are a hoax.
Yeah,
and it's surprisingly common.
25% or so of the population thinks
that. That's just terrifying. I mean, this happened within our lifetime. Within our lifetime.
Within our lifetime, yeah.
So within our lifetime, and people, just based on, you know, looking at a couple websites, are so uncritical in their thinking. It's not that they're dumb. It is that they haven't the skills to discern good evidence from poor evidence. And that's what's the most scary, is that the skills of critical thought are endangered, I don't know.
Or lacking or something.
I don't know. But, yep, there incredible things have been done, and a lot of it was forgotten, you know. They came home from Apollo 17 and, okay, sayonara. Let's have a space shuttle go up every once in a while, but...
In the early days of the space show, I did programming with some of the moon hoax people, thinking that they could be reached.
Oh,
and boy, was that a comeuppance!
Oh, I got to hear about that.
So. Well, you couldn't reach them. It was a circular discussion of nonsense.
Oh.
And so I ultimately quit doing it. And I do think Buzz Aldrin's approach to the issue was the best that I've heard.
Yeah, I like that.
When he knocked that guy in the face.
Yeah. Well, he's had 40 years of, you know, people coming up and saying, you know, prove
did
that you
really
on the
do
moon.
It? Yeah.
Well, the proof is there. Thousands of feet of footage, and
Well, now, and the cameras are now showing the stuff left on the moon.
Yeah.
Well, listen, you know, the internet can make you believe anything. You know, if you don't have the skills of critical thinking, a slick presentation can go a long way over anything that has to do with fact.
So
the asteroid redirect mission, do you see that as kind of an incremental baby step toward maybe being able to do interstellar space someday?
Well, you know, this is the NASA project.
Right.
Which they're saying will give us the skills to subsequently go on to explore the surface of Mars.
Yeah, well, be wary of what they sell and tell you.
Oh yeah. That's the public consumption line of the function of that project.
That's the snake oil. Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't make any natural sense. You know, it doesn't instantly, when you think of asteroid. Oh yeah, then that sets you up to plant. You know, start the geology expeditions of a different planet. It's a very different very different thing, and I know that, once again, Zubrin has been really critical of this as a plan to get anywhere. But I still support it. I mean, if we're going to give NASA money, okay, let them do whatever they're going to do. I guess what I'm saying is I'm not going to be able to change NASA. So... if they have a really interesting project and we're going to get a lot of science back from it, let's say, yeah, absolutely, go and do it. But I sure wish that they would get serious about Mars, too. Buzz Aldrin, on his Twitter, he has a T-shirt he was wearing the other day, and it says, NASA, get your ass to Mars. So he's even yelling at him.
Well,
Buzz Aldrin yelling at NASA.
He has called me many times to brainstorm to try to come up with a strategy to get people to Mars. But he's still thinking the government needs to play a big role in it. And he has that cycler idea in terms of technology.
Yeah. He's the most interesting thinker, I think, of the moon guys. I think he's the most interesting thinker on this.
Well, he's definitely a forward thinker.
He sure is.
There's no doubt about that, about Buzz. And he's up there in years, so he's doing great. It's probably helped keeping him healthy and strong.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
But so space advocacy. So there's a lot of space advocates running around the country, a lot of organizations. You know, there's a blog where you can read anything and everything, you know, having to do with space, some of it.
Yeah, you can't keep up with it. Keep up with space news.
Yeah, so is this a productive thing to have our views, our goals, objectives? We're as scattered and divided and as diverse as the country is right now. There's no cohesion in the space community in terms of a unified goal. Should we all combine our energies and forces, say, to go to Mars or to do this or that? We're all over the board.
Well, I don't know, you know, if that's the best approach, if a big unified approach would be better. You know, we had a unified national project to put people on the moon, and it stopped. Stopped cold. So I simply don't know. I think we're going to have to see. Let's see. You know, it's a very interesting time to see this completely new approach to, generally, I call it humans in space, just a general phrase about humans in space. And it's a completely different paradigm than, you know, the the right stuff sort of mentality, or the, only the sort of iron-jawed test pilots. No, the, all kinds of different people are trying to do this, and the technology is being worked on. It's a very different thing, and I think it's awfully interesting. I really hope some part of it works. And again, I'm just going with sheer numbers. If you know, it's great that so many brains are engaged in it, and maybe, you know, just a few, even if most of it doesn't work, all we need is a couple of things that really make it a lot cheaper and easier to get to space.
So you,
and as they say, you know, once you're out of the gravity well, once you're about 10 minutes off of the surface of the Earth, you're most of the way to most places in our solar system. It's that first 10 minutes getting out of Earth gravity that...
Absolutely. So it's kind of like that old thing where you throw a blank across, you know, at the skillet and hope that a little bit of it sticks.
There we go.
Something like that, yeah.
That's right. See what sticks.
See what sticks. We're approaching the end of the show. Do you have any summary you want to give us, pearls of wisdom or takeaways that you think should be guiding lights for us?
Well, just the... I guess right back from the beginning, you know, there was a question on why is this important, and I have started to, because I do the talks or interviews and so on, I've started to try and figure out ways to make a concise point, and one of them is space colonization as species survival, not an abandonment of Earth, but an insurance policy for humanity, and also it's... I think it is a responsibility and not a luxury. You know, we buy insurance policy for our own life in case something terrible happens. Well, what about an insurance policy for humanity itself? People have worked on that, on putting archives of all human knowledge on the moon, for example. That's great, but if there's nobody around to read it or use that information, I don't think it's particularly great. So put some people on Mars. And this isn't unusual. And it's not a wacko idea. This is some, what's his name, from the last generation, Carl Sagan. He was in the 1980s in his Cosmos program. Ultimately, that was all about putting people into space colonization. He's a very real respected person, and for good reason. So it's not a crazy idea. And then just recently, it's Stephen Hawking. He's publicly advocated... got to go to space. These aren't even archaeologists who are familiar with the record that shows this catastrophe that all ancient civilizations have had. So it's not a crazy idea. It is an insurance policy for our species. It is a responsibility rather than a luxury. That's what I would, I guess that's how I would wrap
up. And that's a good way to wrap it up. So I definitely want to thank you for being with us and talking to us, especially on your birthday.
Oh, thanks very much. This was the most fun I've had in an interview or a talk for a long time. Please, if you have any other topics you want to talk about, just give me a call. I'd be thrilled to come back on.
Absolutely. I'm sure we will touch base again down the road now that we know one another.
Fantastic.
I look forward to talking to you again maybe later in the year about this and other topics.
Just send me an email.
Okay, or if you got an idea for something you think would fly really nicely, send it to me and let's put it together.
I'll do that, David.
Thank you again. Happy birthday again, and all the best, and we appreciate your being here with us.
Thank you, and thanks to all the people who called and wrote in.
Okay, and listeners, all right. Dennis Wingo is on tomorrow night regarding his recent blog article about the Apollo era, and I urge you to read it. The links are in the newsletter. And Dennis is always a great guest, so check us out 7 p.m. tomorrow evening. Thank you all for listening to The Space Show. Goodbye.